Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Not sure if you've ever tuned into TV shows like House or Grey's Anatomy, in which doctors are portrayed as routinely making dramatic life-saving decisions. But if you have, perhaps you've wondered, where are the nurses? Even though the popular image is of nurse as the doctor's right-hand woman or man, the reality is that training for the profession is rigorous and demanding, and that nurses work on the front line of medical care every day in numerous capacities. In fact, since the Affordable Care Act was implemented 6 years ago, nursing has become even more salient to the nation's healthcare system as nurses take a more prominent role in primary care. Advanced practice registered nurses, in many cases, do work once considered the domain of physicians. And so this hour, we take an in-depth look at what the modern nursing profession is all about. If you are a nurse or work elsewhere in the medical field, we'd love to have your input. The number is 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And we are joined this hour by Margot Brooks Carthon, who is in studio with us. She is an assistant professor of nursing at the University of Pennsylvania and a registered nurse practitioner. Margot, welcome to Radio Times.
Hello, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Also in studio, Lisa Lappin-Morid is a registered nurse and nurse practitioner and is also Associate Chief Nursing Officer at Cooper University Healthcare. Great to have you along, Lisa.
Hi, Mary. Thank you.
Sure. And joining us by phone, Julie Rovner, Senior Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Welcome back, Julie.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So the Affordable Care Act is helping to reshape the landscape of nursing in this country. First, though, we're going to take a quick detour regarding the ACA, a news update, and then we'll get right back to nursing. So Julie, premiums for mid-level plans under the ACA are going up by quite a bit, an average of 25% next year. And this is compared to about 7% for this year. So why such a big jump?
Well, you know, the first thing before we say anything else is that we're going to discuss this. The Affordable Care Act is a very large law. There's been an enormous amount of attention to these premiums, to the exchanges. The exchanges are really they're a big part of the law, but they're a small part of the health system. We're talking about 5% of Americans who get their insurance this way, so this is definitely not everybody. And the other thing to point out is that, yes, the average is 25%. It's actually 22% if you look at the states that have their own exchanges, too. But in some states, premiums are actually going down. In other states, they're going up tremendously. Now, that said, there's a couple of reasons. In some of these states, insurers dramatically underpriced their plans. They had no idea what they were going to get, and they decided to go low and hope to make it up on volume, and that really didn't happen for most of them. So they've underpriced. There are a couple of federal programs that were in place for the first 3 years to help insurers who miscalculated, who ended up with too many sick people, or who underpriced for some other reasons. Two of those three programs are going away after this year. And then also some of these plans did not as good a job controlling our costs as other plans. So those are the main reasons why premiums are going up. And it's not a shock to those of us who've been following it, how big some of the increases are, but definitely they're way bigger than they were in the past.
Yeah. How is the Obama administration reacting?
Well, they point out correctly that for most of the people who buy through the exchanges, they get tax subsidies to help them. And the subsidies are not based on the cost of the plant. The subsidies are based on the percentage of income. So if you're getting a subsidy, basically your subsidy makes up the difference between what you're required to pay and how much the plan costs. So you'll get that. That difference will go up. So the government will pay that increase, basically, and you won't. If you're getting, if you're only required to pay $150 a month for your insurance based on your income, then and the plan costs $200, you get a $50 subsidy. But now if the plan's going up from $200 to $400, you're still only required to pay $150, and your subsidy will go up to make the difference. So most people won't even be affected by the increases in premiums. Some people will. There's a couple of million people who are in this market who don't get subsidies, and they will definitely be impacted, although, as I pointed out, not all of them live in the states where premiums are going up a lot. In a few states, premiums are actually going down.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to volume for just a moment. One of the critical issues, not enough young, healthy people have signed up. So, again, what is the administration doing to counter this?
Well, the administration is definitely boosting its outreach to some of these young and healthy people. Interestingly, one of the other provisions of the law that allowed young adults to stay on their parents' health plans until they turn 26 is one of the things that's keeping them out of this individual market. That's something that's very popular. But had that not happened, you would have had a lot of 22 to 26-year-olds probably in the plans, which would have, you know, helped with to make the risk pool healthier. There are, you know, other discussions. You know, one of the other things that didn't happen is that everybody predicted that, oh my goodness, employers are going to stop offering coverage and they're going to send everybody to the exchanges. Well, by and large, that didn't happen. But because it didn't happen, it means that the pools in the exchanges are smaller, and they've turned out to be sicker because it was the sick people who were kept out, you know, before the law went into effect. Insurers could simply not sell to people who had pre-existing conditions, or they could charge them unaffordably high premiums, and they can't do either of those anymore. So all of those sick people who'd basically been kept out of the market have been allowed to come in. They were the first ones to sign up, as everybody knew, but as you point out, there haven't been enough sort of healthy people, not just young people, but healthy people overall, to balance out that risk pool and make these, you know, more economically viable for the insurers. Although, as I point out, some insurers are doing quite well.
Okay, so Julie Robner, two more quick questions on the ACA and the latest, and then we are going to get to nursing. The election might well be critical to the fate of the ACA. Hillary Clinton plans to keep it in place, but with changes, what is she proposing?
Well, she's proposing a lot of things to help with, you know, it's not just the premiums. As I point out, most of the people get, about 85% of the people who are in this market get subsidies to help with their premiums. But there's also other costs that are going up. Deductibles are going up. What you're required to pay, your portion of the bill, co-insurance, co-pays are going up. The cost of prescription drugs is going up. And she wants to deal with all of those things, with things that are making it unaffordable above and beyond the premium. So she has a number of proposals that would help, you know, limit people's out-of-pocket costs. She wants to make it easier for the 19 states that didn't expand Medicaid to do that. The federal government paid the entire amount for the first 3 years. Obviously, we're getting beyond that, so there's 19 states that haven't expanded. She wants to reset the clock so that if those 19 states came in, they would get that 100%. Interestingly, if you look at the states where premiums are going up a lot, those are mostly states that didn't expand Medicaid. That's not a coincidence. Some of those people who otherwise would have gotten Medicaid might be sicker and have ended up in the risk pool and are helping boost premiums. So a lot of these things interact.
All right. We've got about 30 seconds more here on this topic. No love lost among many Republicans for the ACA. Donald Trump wants to scrap it. Easier said than done.
Yes, I think, you know, the Republicans have been saying the whole repeal and replace goes all the way back to the inception of the law, which is now 6 years old. The Republicans haven't really been able to agree on what they want to replace it with, which is an issue we will see next year if there is, as many predict, a Democratic president and a Republican, at least half of the Congress, you know, whether they'll be able to come to some, you know, agreement on ways to at least stabilize it.
We're going to get back to the ACA and talk about its influence on shaping and expanding the nursing profession. But first, let's get into nursing. Margo Brooks-Carthon, how did you come to decide that nursing was what you wanted to do?
Well, Mary, I had several experiences as a high school student having an opportunity to shadow nurses. And in so doing, found myself drawn to the profession. I also had nurses in my family and nurses at church, and so they were always individuals that I looked up to. And so when it was time to pursue a career at 18, I decided to go into nursing. I don't know that I knew everything that nurses did, but it was a wonderful decision that I've never, ever looked back on without anything but pure joy.
And Lisa Lavin-Morad?
So when I was 14, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. So I really became her caregiver for a short period of time. She was young. She was 38 at the time. So she went through her chemotherapy, got better. And as I started to think about what did I want to do as I got older, I really found myself drawn to people and be in a people and a caring type of profession. So nursing really felt very natural for me. And I really felt like I was drawn to the profession.
As we said in the beginning, in the open to this show, there are many nurses, nurse practitioners, who are now starting to do the work that physicians have done. And this is in part thanks to the ACA. But let's talk about you know, as we have some overlap here, the essential differences between nursing and doctoring?
Well, I think part of it has to do, so let's frame nursing before we talk about doctoring. And so if we look at the history of nursing, if you were a nursing student in, let's say, 1916, much of what you would do as a student would have been in a hospital. You would have trained for approximately a year. You would receive a diploma, and you would have worked under the apprenticeship model. So you would have essentially been learning to nurse as you did nursing. This increased as hospitals increased over the first portion of the 20th century. And so there were many, many hospitals that were being constructed and they needed a workforce. And so nurses primarily were trained in that fashion. And so over the course of the 21st century, particularly after World War II, you saw an influx in research and technology. You saw advancements in medical science. And at the same time, you saw a requirement for nurses to have increased skill and increased educational capacity. And so where nurses, you know, in 1916 might have required a year of experience, today's nurses have a minimum of 3 years. Most have a four-year baccalaureate and beyond. Many nurses work with specialized certifications to work with the populations they work with. And so when we talk about nurses today, we really are talking about a highly trained, highly educated workforce, which is required because we have a critically ill population, and we've been able to address that through providing our nursing, you know, workforce with the skills to accommodate a changing population and healthcare needs.
And Lisa, there has been this perception over the decades of nurses being the handmaiden to the doctor. Mm-hmm. Was that perception accurate? And has it changed in 2016?
Oh, it has definitely changed.
It has across the medical field?
I believe so. I believe that it has definitely changed. To exactly what Margo was speaking to, we have really grown as a profession. We have really challenged our nursing students to think critically and to think beyond the task of nursing and really to look at the physiological complexities of a patient and really draw from nursing theorists that we learn under, really to completely look at the patient as a whole, including their family and beyond, to really provide a level of care that is beyond the handmaiden days. You know, it's been a great experience watching the change.
Well, we're up against a break, but just give us a quick tick off a number of different positions that somebody who's listening to this show might not think in regards to nursing. For instance, they're nurse midwives. What else, mm-hmm. Margo?
Okay, so we have 3 million nurses currently working in the U.S., and 60% work in hospitals, 40% work in spaces all over, schools, prisons, shelters. They're researchers like myself. They're administrators. And so there are very few places you may not find a nurse.
All right, we're going to talk more about that in just a moment. Radio Times continues on WHYY in Philadelphia. You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we are talking about the field of nursing in 2016, the public perception of nursing, the daily work that nurses do. We are joined by Lisa Lappin-Morid, who is a registered nurse and nurse practitioner. She is the Associate Chief Nursing Officer at Cooper University Healthcare. Margo Brooks Carthon is an Assistant Professor of Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania and a registered nurse practitioner. And Julie Rovner is Senior Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number to call, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So before we continue, let's get some definitions, because as I was doing research for this show, I'm thinking, okay, registered nurse, nurse practitioner, advanced practice nurse. What do some of these mean?
So a registered nurse is a person who has gone through 3 to 4 years of training, depending upon their school. We do still have some diploma schools out there. So you take a nursing board, a national nursing board, and you become registered as a nurse. Then an a nurse practitioner is, in essence, falls under the umbrella of an advanced practice nurse. An advanced practice nurse is anyone who has an advanced degree in nursing, so someone who has their master's in nursing. So that would be anyone who is a nurse practitioner, a certified nurse anesthetist. Mm-hmm. So you would see fall under the category of advanced practice nursing. So someone who has gone beyond the baccalaureate and advanced their degree and has received specialty certification in their field of expertise.
And in talking to some people in my life who happen to be nurses, I get the impression that you really need to get that, the BSN,
yes,
in order to be competitive in today's nursing field. Is that the case, Margot?
I would certainly agree. One of the things that we've noticed, and I alluded to it previously, is that as a profession, we've been required to continue to advance our educational mission because patients are critically ill. And so in order to meet the needs of our contemporary patient populations, as a health profession, we've had to continue to set standards. And where in 1916, the standard was a one-year diploma, we've increasingly seen that outcomes, research tells us that patient outcomes improve dramatically when they're cared for by nurses who are working with a baccalaureate degree. In 2010, the Institute of Medicine, now the National Academy of Medicine, with Robert Wood Johnson, put out a seminal report called the Future of Nursing Report, and it actually called for nursing to get to 80% of its workforce to have a baccalaureate by 2020. We're not quite there yet, but we are since 2013. It's been the first time where the majority of nurses currently working hold a baccalaureate degree.
Lisa, give us a sense of some of the critical situations that a nurse might face on the job in any given day.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. I guess it depends, obviously, on which field you're working. But
So in our institution, we're a level one trauma center. So our patients come in through the trauma admitting or through the emergency department, come in having just had a terrible accident or a heart attack, or they're having difficulty breathing. And generally, the first person that they see is the nurse. The nurse is the one who instantly assesses the patient and immediately starts to develop their own problem list of, you know, do they have an active airway? Are they able to breathe? Is there a pulse? What do we do next? So the nurses are your frontline team to identify those situations. So you can have that experience. You can then transition into the operating room, where our nurses are highly skilled at having the foresight to anticipate the needs of the surgeon or what could go on in the case. You know, is there something that they'll need? Is there something that something may happen to the patient? What can I do to prevent that from happening? And then you can transition out to intensive care or to a medical surgical unit where, you know, you may just walk in and see your patient and everything's great and you're having a conversation with them. And the next thing you know, they're not talking back to you. Mm-hmm. So what has happened in that moment? Are they having a stroke? Are they having a heart attack? What has happened? And instantly you start to think, what could be going on with this person? So those critical situations happen throughout nursing, even into home care.
Yeah. Well, so what I'm hearing is it's not only the education, but you really need a certain sort of strength of character to do the job well.
Oh, yes. I think that you need to be a true advocate. And I think that you learn that through nursing. You don't come out of school and you say, hey, I'm going to be a patient advocate. You learn, you develop confidence in yourself. You develop the ability to say, hey, you know what, my patient does come first and I'm going to challenge or I'm going to question and I'm going to ask what else can be done. So you do have to have courage and you have to have strength to be able to stand in those you know, it's crucial conversations sometimes.
Margot?
And I'd also add, one of the, I would call unique aspects of nursing is our ability to think about patients holistically. And so when we move from the acute care into community settings where 40% of nurses work, as a nurse, you have to be an advocate and recognize kind of the social determinants that influence health. And so helping patients empower themselves to make healthy decisions and to be able to manage symptoms in the home. And so as much as we are on the front lines of assessing acute illnesses as they arise in healthcare settings, we're also on the front line of communities creating a culture of health and health promotion and health prevention, prevention of illness.
Yeah. Sounds like a good time to bring the ACA back into the conversation. So the Affordable Care Act went into effect 6 years ago. There's a huge focus on primary care, and the ACA took some sizable steps to promote and support the practice of nurse practitioners. Julie Rovner, what sort of provisions are we talking about?
Well, the Affordable Care Act did a number of things, anticipating the need for more nurses, starting with the fact that there had been a nursing shortage, significant nursing shortage, and one of the reasons for the shortage is that there weren't enough nurses to teach other nurses. So there was more money for nurse educators. The idea also, of course, that they knew that under the law there would be more people insured, so there would also be a need for more nurses, more caregivers for those people who are newly insured, and the demographics of the aging baby boom generation, which includes a lot of nurses who will retire, so you need to have nurses to come take their places. But I think the biggest push from the Affordable Care Act was what we've been sort of alluding to, which are these changes in the delivery system. The idea, as you mentioned, not just to get more primary care, but to get more cost-efficient care, to see the healthcare practitioner who's not necessarily the most expensive or the most highly trained, but to see the appropriate person for your appropriate problem. And that includes pharmacists who are now practicing, but particularly nurses. I mean, there are now nurses in, you know, many of these outpatient clinics, and people. I'm finding just in my sort of looking at the whole healthcare workforce issue that people who are seeing nurses, people who might not have thought of going to a nurse for primary care and yet now are completely devoted to the nurses that they see. So I think there's been a change in public perception as well from this.
Yeah, I was going to ask, Lisa, do you sometimes hear of pushback from patients who say, as the nurse practitioner perhaps is writing a prescription, where's the doctor?
Oh, sure. I've heard that in my own practice as a nurse practitioner.
And how do you react?
So I think it's important to take that opportunity to educate your patient that you are a healthcare provider as an advanced practice nurse, as a nurse practitioner, and that you work independently, yet you work closely with your physician colleagues so that you can deliver high quality care to the patient, that you are educated to do so, and that you are more than a physician extender. You are a provider for them. And in my experience, once that patient begins to see you as their provider and they build that trust and see you as part of their healthcare team, really wonderful things start to happen. And to exactly what Julie shared, you know, patients start to ask for the nurse practitioner more and the physician less. Not to offend any of my physician colleagues, but I think that they make a connection in a different way.
And Margo, so we're talking about writing prescriptions. What are some of the other procedures, I suppose, or things that nurse practitioners now do that were once the purview of doctors?
I think In addition to writing prescriptions, do you see nurse practitioners working more autonomously and independently following a panel of patients? We have nurse-managed clinics. We have community PACE facilities, which were programmed for all-inclusive care for the elderly. And many of these models of care are allowing nurse practitioners to manage kind of the comprehensive care needs from A to Z, referring when appropriate. And so in many, because of the ACA, we're seeing opportunities for advanced practice nurses to become kind of the leaders and take the lead in management of chronic and acute care populations.
Julie Rovner, among the provisions not fulfilled, at least according to what I've seen, are funding levels for nurse-managed health centers have not reached the amounts provided in the ACA. Why is that?
Well, for a lot of programs in the ACA, you know, there was funding. Some of it had funding provided, and a lot of it had funding that needed to be provided by Congress. And the Republican Congress, in particular, has not wanted to fund a lot of the more optional programs in the health law, mostly as part of their objection to the health law period, and a desire to sort of not see it not work, if you will, so that they could then repeal it. So there's been a lot of difficulty getting funding for a lot of programs. I mean, this has been true over many years. It's hard to get Congress to fund things that are not, you know, right in front of them as an emergency, and I think this is definitely one of them.
Yeah. All right, to the phones we go. Franco in Toms River. You are live on Radio Times. Hi, Franco.
Hello there.
So what's your question?
I hope you can hear me okay. I'm on Bluetooth. Is that all right?
We sure can.
Okay, thanks for taking my call. I saw a program a few nights ago on 60 Minutes. They were talking about the supercomputer Watson. We all know Watson from the episode of Jeopardy. Watson won Jeopardy. And apparently now Watson has gone to med school and has the ability to read thousands of current medical journals in a matter of seconds. Read radiology reports, provide differential diagnosis. And I'm wondering if the nurses today on your board have given any thought to those implications in the future for nursing.
Thanks, Franco, for the call to Radio Times. Margot, so technology develops, and how do nurses work with that, or does it even take over some of the, the job description?
I'm not overly concerned that technology will take over the role of nurses, particularly because nursing is an art and a science, and it absolutely requires the human touch, it requires compassion, it requires empathy, and it requires connection, human connection. And I would argue that Watson likely won't be able to offer that.
Lisa?
I completely agree. I think that there are some real benefits to the technology that we're seeing today, and we have opportunities for telehealth, telemedicine, really some great opportunities that we're working with right now in a lot of our institutions. In talking to our frontline staff, when I talk to them about challenges, you know, that they see in the way that they deliver care today, the computer is often a challenge for them. They feel, to what Margot was saying, it places a barrier to them to be able to make that connection with the person and to really say, you know, I'm going to have a conversation with you right here. I'm going to try to move this computer screen out of the way, although this is what I have to document into. So I think that it's something that we're still learning to work with as healthcare professionals as a whole. You know, where does this fit into our world?
All right. Cecil comments, nurses are underpaid. I was a nurse for many years in a school district. I served as many as 600 students and over 50 faculty. Now, that was that perhaps, Cecil, this was a while ago because I was also looking at some nurse salaries, which look pretty good. But again, it depends on what sort of education you've obtained. Margot, you want to address that?
It depends on where you live. And so the mean salary for nurses is probably about $68,000. But again, it depends. If you live on the West Coast, if you live in New York, because of cost of living, your salary could be much more, closer to $120,000 to $130,000. But again, some of that's predicated on advanced degree procurement. And yeah. So the longer or perhaps the more advanced education you have, your salary potential increases.
Well, yeah, I was reading in the Huffington Post, a certified registered nurse anesthetist, $133,000. Mm-hmm. General nurse practitioner, $97,000. Mm-hmm. A certified nurse midwife, $89,000. Mm-hmm. And again, those are nurses with advanced degrees.
Right.
But still, it's not bad.
No, it's not. You know, I think that the public perception is still out there. Nursing is predominantly a female-driven career. And I think, you know, that there still may be some inequities in there. But I will say we have definitely come a long way to really be receiving appropriate compensation. Absolutely.
Well, Julie Ravner, a big issue anywhere in the workplace is wage inequality. There are more women than men in nursing. Are salaries among the genders generally comparable?
Well, I haven't seen that. I've seen the gender breakdown. But one thing I will say is that in I've been doing a lot of work on medical education and the healthcare workforce. And one of the things that I'm seeing is that a lot of college students, you know, when they're deciding what they want to do for a career, are opting not to go to medical school just because it is so expensive. Yes, you'll make more when you get out, but the return on investment is much better for some of these, either you know, nurse practitioner programs or, you know, all the advanced practice nursing or even physician assistant programs. You know, what you pay and the time it takes for you to get educated compared to what you'll earn when you get out, a lot of people are opting to do that instead. And I think a lot of people in these sort of, they call sort of mid-level healthcare practitioners, seem to be much happier in their work than perhaps people who've gone on to the really extensive training it takes to become, you know, a physician specialist.
Margo, you'd mentioned earlier that it depends on where you live sometimes. Mm-hmm. How you make. The greatest need for primary care in this country is not necessarily in the urban or suburban areas, is it? I've read more rural, and this is what the ACA is targeting?
I would say yes and no. Okay. Pennsylvania, for instance, has a number of medically underserved areas, probably close to 160. Some are in rural, some are in urban spaces. Many urban spaces have primary care deserts, and because it may or may not be as lucrative to open a primary care practice in an urban space where you may have a larger proportion of individuals living with lower incomes. And so you'd be surprised. Well, that's the importance of thinking about how we utilize our workforce. Nurse practitioners are more likely to work in primary care. They're more likely to work in underserved areas. And so as we think about how do we address the needs of our current demographics, using a nursing workforce to its full capacity is certainly one of those ideas that we should look forward to.
All right. We'll talk some more about that in just a moment. You are listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We're talking about the profession of nursing. Julie Rovner is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Lisa Lappin-Morid is registered nurse and a nurse practitioner and associate chief nursing officer at Cooper University Healthcare. And Margo Brooks Carthon is an assistant professor of nursing at the University of Pennsylvania. Stay with us for more just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, joined by Margo Brooks Carthon, an assistant professor of nursing at the University of Pennsylvania, and also Lisa Lappin-Morid is associate chief nursing officer at Cooper University Healthcare. Julie Rovner is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. We're taking calls at 888-477-9499. Promise we'll get to some of them. But I wanted to get just one more point regarding the ACA. After it went into effect, there apparently was some fallout in that sicker patients who previously could not afford insurance entered the system. Perhaps they hadn't had care in a long time. Perhaps they hadn't seen a doctor. And what this meant was an extra load on medical facilities and therefore on nurses. And Lisa, have you experienced any of this in the 6 years since the ACA was implemented?
Well, certainly. I think that the patients that are coming into the hospital are They are of a higher acuity. They are just sicker. You know, we're seeing these people come in and really trying to develop ways to give them the support that they need at home, taking a look at our readmission rates, and how can we transition them to home with a supportive team in place so that as these, as their different illnesses come up, they don't make the emergency room or the emergency department their next visit. Instead, we can provide the care in the home. I don't think that we have quite figured out how to shift that pendulum a little bit to really put a good emphasis on the outpatient experience so that the patients are cared for in the home and have the tools that they need to care for themselves. We're working through that as a country right now.
Margo, let's talk about nurse workload. Is that a critical issue for many in the profession?
Absolutely, and I'd say it continues to be so. And so much of the work of myself and colleagues in the Center for Health Outcomes and Policy Research at Penn School of Nursing looks at exactly the interface between how nursing care is delivered and organized in patient outcomes. And we found that when nursing workloads are high and nurses are caring for too many patients or aren't working in under good working conditions, that patient outcomes suffer. And that's particularly the case when we look at the outcomes of minorities, particularly older minorities who are low income. And what we found is that these are patients who come to healthcare settings typically sicker with more medical problems, and that we've not quite found a way to organize the nursing care to meet the needs of these very vulnerable populations. And so that's kind of an area of what we call precision nursing, how we need to really look at subpopulations and think about how to staff and how to accommodate using frontline care providers accordingly.
And Julie Rovner, has the ACA, to the best of your knowledge, addressed this situation with the influx of the sicker patients and then the resulting strain on medical facilities?
Obviously, lawmakers knew that this would happen when they opened up insurance to many people who hadn't had it and expanded Medicaid. One of the big delivery system parts of the Affordable Care Act, you know, talked about accountable care organizations and medical homes. And basically, these are ways to encourage teamwork among medical professionals. I think, as I talked about earlier, getting patients to the right level of care at the right time. And that's what everyone is still working out, figuring out which of those models works best. You know, maybe you need just a community health worker or a medical technician. Maybe you need a nurse. Maybe you need a doctor. You know, at different times, you're going to need different types of healthcare professionals, and organizing it in both a cost-effective and patient-friendly way to get people the best care at the best time. Nobody has quite figured out how to do it yet, but lots and lots and lots of people are working on that right now.
And back to the phones we go. Jake in Philadelphia, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. So something else in addition to advanced practice nurses that's been increasingly common in, you know, healthcare and primary care is seeing a physician's assistant. And I was wondering what impact that has on nursing. Is it possible that it's a problem because someone who might otherwise become an advanced practice nurse becomes a physician assistant or things like that?
Interesting question. Thanks, Jake. Lisa?
Actually, as an advanced practice nurse, I welcome physician assistants. Physician assistants, that profession is another opportunity for us to provide care to our patients and really to expand our provider pool. I don't think that nurses see physician's assistants as competitors. We actually see them more as colleagues. And in many practices, you'll see physicians, physician's assistants, and nurse practitioners, all part of the care team, just aligning skill sets a little bit differently.
All right. Comment from Martin. My primary care doctor's office is a private practice in the downtown area of my town. In the past 2 years, I think I've only seen my physician two or three times. I've continued to see the nurse practitioner every time by request and also by chance. She is wonderful. I'm curious, though, is there anything my physician can do that my nurse practitioner can't do? Margo? So again, break down the role of the physician, right, the nurse practitioner, and how they work together.
And I'd absolutely say that there are different skill sets and expertise. And I don't think that nurse practitioners are trying to usurp the role or the responsibility of physicians. And certainly if you went to your primary care doctor and there was something outside of the nurse practitioner's scope, outside of her comfort, she would either refer as appropriate to a specialist, and if the physician was there, would be able to consult with the physician. And so I think it's important to think of nurse practitioners as, when appropriate, the leaders autonomously in healthcare, but also working in collaboration with physicians when appropriate.
All right. Betty in Philadelphia is standing by. Welcome to Radio Times, Betty.
Hey, Mary. Thanks for the conversation, ladies. The greatest profession in the world and the most trusted. I was a nurse, or am a nurse, and was a nurse for 20 years. And in 2003, I started a company called Guardian Nurses Healthcare Advocates because I saw that patients needed help getting through the system. And now, 13 years later, we have a team of 13 nurses all of whom have 20 years of experience and are navigating patients, you know, through this system. And I think that nurses, if, you know, they have an entrepreneurial spirit, can contribute, you know, to the new, to what the new healthcare system is going to look like. And I'd just like to hear Margo and Lisa talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Thanks, Betty.
Yeah, Betty, thank you. I think that we're kind of, nursing continues to reinvent itself in terms of its capacity. And so when I think about the things that nurses are doing in terms of business and technology and entrepreneurship, it blows me away. I teach the Intro to Nursing course, and the sky is absolutely the limit to what these new nurses who are coming out within the next 4 years, the future that they'll be able to chart is so bright. And their capacity to integrate technology and build new applications and layer that on the foundations of compassion and care. I think that we are never going to see nursing as static. We won't be able to. We change too much as a society. And that to the degree that nurses are able to continue to be creative and compassionate, we'll continue to be able to meet the healthcare needs of our future. And in addition to that, nursing itself has become more diverse. And so when I graduated from nursing school 20 years ago, there were 50 of us graduating, one was a male. And so now when I look across my nursing class, 15% of the class are men, and 20% are students from diverse backgrounds. And so we have an opportunity as a profession to provide holistic and patient-centered care that's culturally competent and that meets the needs and the expectations of the patients and populations we serve.
So in higher education, are there barriers that some in diverse populations have to leap to get into the nursing profession? You need a real strong background in math and in science.
Absolutely. You do. But you also need
What's
to be a people person, and you have to be a good communicator, and you have to be a good team player. And so while it's important to have strong math and science skills, we don't want math and science to be a barrier because you have
to. Sometimes coming out of these schools,
it
you
does.
Know, the education and might not be as rigorous as in other places. Yeah,
and we have found that sometimes minorities or those from disadvantaged backgrounds may not have strong math and science backgrounds. But what we're seeing is more pipeline programs that are identifying those individuals in high schools. We have more magnet and science academies. And so nursing has done a really good job of reaching back into high schools and partnering so that we can identify individuals in their sophomore and junior years even to have a sense for what they need to do to be prepared to come into nursing as a profession.
Julie Robner, what's the job market look like for nurses? And I'm thinking in relation to the ACA, I'm imagining there's a lot of opportunity.
Yeah, the job market is good. I mean, you know, the good side and the downside of the fact that the U.S. spends $3 trillion a year on healthcare means that there's a lot of jobs in healthcare. In fact, healthcare has been one of the biggest drivers of job growth in this recovery, you know, since the Great Recession. And as we've talked about, you know, nurses are in a particularly good position to encourage not just more care and better care, but more cost-effective care. And that's why, you know, as we've mentioned, there's so many different kinds of nurses doing so many different things in so many different places. And as I also mentioned, you know, one of the big problem, which I think has been largely overcome, is that there were more people who wanted to go into nursing than there were people to teach them how to become nurses.
Yeah.
So there has been a big emphasis on getting more nurse educators so that you could train the people who want to be nurses to fill the jobs that are actually there.
Yeah. I'd also heard that, you know, since the Great Recession, a number of nurses who might have wanted to retire back then didn't feel they were able to, and now they're looking to step away from the job market. So that, you know, that just adds to the opportunity that's there. Mm-hmm. Well, Susan Hassmiller writes in American Nurse Today that clinical experience isn't enough. It's also important for nurses to be at the table and familiar with governance and strategy and fundraising if nurses are to help lead the country to a healthcare system that's more equitable. Margo, in your opinion, are enough nurses at the table in boardrooms and on committees?
I'd have to say yes and no. I think the number of nurses in those positions are growing. But I think that most individuals would be surprised to know that there are 3 million nurses working in the U.S. and that nurses are actually the largest proportion of healthcare providers. And if you look at that in combination to where nurses sit in terms of making health policy decisions, there's a distortion in that. So they represent a lot of the frontline care, but they're not making the decisions. And so sometimes there's a misalignment between the decisions that are being made and the challenges that frontline providers are seeing. And so having their voice would be even more important and potent given how close they are to the patient interface.
Lisa.
Yeah, I've always found it very important to be close to your professional organizations, to read the publications that are going out, to really have an understanding of what is going on in national policy for nursing so that you can be an educated professional. I think that Margo's absolutely right. When you look at the numbers, I'd like to see nursing have a little bit more of a public face at the table. I work in an organization where I'm really proud to say that my president and CEO is a nurse. Our COO is a nurse. So we really have really strong nursing leadership in our little world at Cooper. But beyond there, I think that we definitely have opportunity to see nursing leaders take more of a leadership role in the country.
And Julie Rovner, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I think I would just say that, you know, particularly right now in a time when the health system is changing so much and so fast that it's important to have, you know, every healthcare provider at the table to talk about how best to reconfigure the system so that it works better. And it's not just for patients, so that it works better for the health professionals. I mean, a lot of doctors, you know, say that they suffer from burnout because everything comes to them. Well, everything doesn't necessarily have to come to them, that the work of caring for patients could be done in a more, in a more friendly way for both patients and the healthcare providers.
So I'm going to kind of make a right turn here with the questioning. Margo, what is it about your own nursing career that has surprised you?
Wow, that is a good question. I think the thing that surprised me the most is that I haven't lost my passion for it. I suppose that when you do something for a long time, it can start to feel like a job. But I always say I was purposed to be a nurse, and so it surprises me that I still have the same passion now for nursing that I had when I was an 18-year-old going into the profession 20-plus years ago.
How did you manage to avoid a sense of burnout, especially since it can be such a high stress or a high pressure job sometimes, depending on where you are?
I think I've found my calling because I have brought into the notion of nurses being advocates. And in my core, I am an advocate for social justice. And so because much of my work really thinks about how do we improve healthcare conditions for marginalized populations and communities, it's helped me marry my profession to core values. And so it's the reason I get up every day.
All right. And Lisa Lavin-Morad, you've had a little time to think about that question. Is there anything about your career that has surprised you?
I think that the biggest surprise to me was how true nursing is to me. It really is who I am. And it sounds cliche. It sounds like, oh, sure, you were born to be a nurse. But I really was. It really is everything about me. I am an advocate. I can't believe I'm this smart sometimes. It just amazes me that, wow, that made sense. That light bulb really went off in my head. It really resonates with me, and I love the profession, and I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunity to grow and to stay an active member of my professional organizations, of my team, and to really be the leader that I've been able to become through many mentors. It's been wonderful.
Lisa Lavin-Morad, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Lisa is a registered nurse, nurse practitioner, and associate chief nursing officer at Cooper University Healthcare. And Margo Brooks-Carthon, it was a pleasure as well.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Mary.
Margo is an assistant professor of nursing at the University of Pennsylvania and a registered nurse practitioner. And Julie Rovner, as always, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Julie, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Don't forget to check out our Facebook page and podcast. Head to whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening.